You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the first of two episodes where I'm talking to a comic book artist called Dave, whose most famous work was with writer Alan Moore. In this episode, I'm talking to Dave Gibbons, who drew Watchmen, which is currently being turned into a multi-million dollar blockbuster, and he's also drawn a variety of seminal comics on both sides of the Atlantic, from Green Lantern to Dan Dare. I'm also talking to Dave about his career so far, working on his more personal project, The Originals, and what he's experienced so far of the Hollywood adaptation of his most famous work.
You've worked in the field about 30 years now. Your first work, I was reading in Studio Space yesterday, various titles for IPC, but it was your work for 2000 AD that first sort of brought you to people's attention.
Yeah, I mean, I started in 1973, and I really kind of broke in by hanging around the offices and doing lettering. And then I heard one of the artists was going on holiday, and I filled in doing some work. My really early work actually was for DC Thompson, which I did through an agent. And that really was my education as an artist, because I'd send them pencil pages and they'd send them back with a critique, or maybe with an overlay with a redrawing suggestion. And although DC Thompson comics are very kind of traditional, they really did teach me the nuts and bolts of clear visual storytelling. Okay. But yeah, 2000 AD was very important to my career and to a lot of my contemporaries. We were of the generation that wanted to do comics. Before then, a lot of the people who worked in comics really aspired to be magazine illustrators or novelists. But our generation, which I think was the generation that had grown up on the first imported American comics, our life's ambition was to do comics. And 2000 AD was the perfect vehicle at the perfect time.
Well, I mean, I've read some of your Rogue Trooper strips when they were reprinted in books by Titan.
Right.
And I think they still stand up very well now, because there's something about, you've got a kind of a clarity to your work, but at the same time you know when to use heavy shading for impact. And I think when it comes to these sort of future war strips, there needs to be that mixture of clarity and chiaroscuro in order to bring some kind of realism but the same grittiness to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I generally try and adapt my drawing style. I mean, obviously, there's a basic way I draw that you can always tell it's a Dave Gibbons drawing. But I do try and use different materials to suit what I'm doing. Rogue Trooper was drawn with a really cheap Platinum fountain pen, and I used bits of tea towel, rough tea towel, to put background texture in and keep and put a lot of solid black in it to make it heavy. So it has got that gritty, sort of dirty look. Watchmen, for instance, I drew with quite a hard dip pen and then put in hatching afterwards to give it a kind of a very clear line look to it. Other things I draw with a brush to make it look smoother. So, yeah, I always try and, you know, kind of horses for courses. Always. And frankly, it's not only an artistic decision because of a look that I want. It stops you getting bored with just drawing with the same stuff all the time. It gives you a new challenge, a different way of working, you know. So, yeah, that's the thing that I'm really pleased you noticed it, because I thought I might be the only one.
And so when you've got new scripts that you're working on, and perhaps in a genre that you've not worked on before, do you think, I might try this technique because it's something I haven't tried, but it might suit this particular kind of story?
Yeah, and I mean, not even just the tools that I would use to draw it, or the amount of black or whatever I put, but the way the page is laid out as well. I mean, you know, you can look at any page of Watchmen and you are in no doubt that it's a page of Watchmen, because it's done on that 9-panel grid, which I suggested to Alan at the beginning as a way of formalising it and really, you know, using a very elementary framework to contain all the complexity. The same with The Originals, which I wrote and drew later. That, again, it's in black and white. It's on a different kind of grid, the different lettering style. Again, every page is unmistakably from that book. Martha Washington, which was a kind of a wild, crazy, future, scary, funny romp, I did in a much more anarchic layout, more kind of poster layouts, and bleeding off the page and everything. Watchmen wouldn't have worked if it had full-page bleeds, or if it had, you know, wild panel arrangements. It would have just looked like another comic. So, yeah, I'm always very aware of giving everything a distinct character as far as I can.
And you've worked in both black and white and then in comics that have been coloured. Do you do colouring yourself, or have you left it to other people?
I I'm not a natural colourist. Okay. I mean, I can colour. Mm. My training was working for DC Thompson and reading books about art. So I've never been trained to paint. And the frustration always was that I had an idea of the way I wanted the thing to look in colour, but with my somewhat limited abilities, I could never actually get it to look like that. Mm. Sometimes I'd be more successful, but I used to use an airbrush, and I used stick-down colour that Lettretone used to do, and coloured pencils, and watercolour and inks. But it wasn't really until computer software got cheap and quick that I really got the kind of colour effects that I wanted to get. I don't colour a lot of my own work because it's really quite time consuming. By the time you've pencilled it and inked it to colour it again. But I'm very keen on having control over the colour, and I've been lucky enough to work with John Higgins, who's a wonderful colourist, Angus Mackay, who coloured a lot of the Martha Washington stuff, Robin Smith, who coloured the first set of Martha Washington. And I've always done it in the way that I've given them colour notes and then sort of had a look at the work they've done. And basically, I'm quite happy with just what they do. I would only make a correction if it was for continuity or story purposes. Mm. So that seems to be the happy medium. But I do keep my hand in, and I do occasionally do maybe a cover that I've coloured on the computer. I did, not to go on about colour too much, I did a sketch for somebody the other day in their sketchbook, and they wanted a full colour sketch, or finished drawing actually, a commission piece. And I got my paints out of the drawer, and it's so long since I used them, they were all just solid lumps of rock in the jars. So I had to go out and buy some more colours, and I actually had to teach myself again how to put colour on, you know. It's an area that I don't really dabble in very much, but I enjoy it.
Because I remember particularly with Martha Washington, I'd read Angus McKee's books that he'd just done as, you know, doing all the art before. And he has that kind of heavy metal aesthetic going on with his work.
Yeah.
So when it came to doing those strips, it sort of added an additional kind of European look to the art. But at the same time, it's Frank Miller's satire on some American foreign policy. So that was an interesting contrast between the way it's being written and the way it's being presented.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And it's... It kind of makes it fresh because it isn't quite what you expect. And the thing about Martha Washington, in a way, it's a comic without a genre, really, because it's kind of science fiction. It's kind of satirical. It got a bit Western at one point where she's out in the desert. It's a war comic. It's a love comic, a romance comic, you know. We're in the process of putting together the definitive collection because... Mm. You know, there are a couple of mini-series and then odd issues here and there and odd stories. So we're going to gather the whole thing together. Hopefully we're going to do it as an oversized book in the kind of absolute format. Mm. And again, I've kept lots of the notes and Frank's outlines and sketches of scenes and things. So we're hoping that's going to be out in 2009.
Cool.
It's funny, people who like Martha Washington, you know, it's not a huge fan favourite of a book, probably because it isn't superhero and it isn't. But the people who do like Martha Washington seem to really like it. So I'm hoping once it's all in one place and it can be read as a coherent story that we'll get more people on board. But so that's Martha.
Okay. And then when it came to Watchmen, it was John Higgins who coloured that. With knowing that the art was going to be coloured and that you're working to this sort of strict nine-panel regime, as it were, how did that affect your art when it came to sort of plotting the layout of the pages and sort of like, you know, thinking this bit's going to be much heavier in the inking, this is going to be more sort of cross-hatching?
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem with colouring is if you don't know who's going to be colouring it, you have to draw kind of in a defensive way. Mm. You have to make the drawing so solid that nothing the colourist does can actually undermine the drawing. Mm. You know, you have to make the light sources very, very clear. You have to make sure that the line strength will hold, even if the colour goes over it. But when you're working with somebody that you know and whose decisions you respect, you know, because I employed John because I knew he would make it look not like a regular American comic. My instruction to him was don't make it look like a regular American comic. And we've both been looking at a lot of European stuff, which tends to use sometimes a much more vivid palette than an American comic, sometimes a much more subdued palette. Mm. So what John went for was using secondary colours, lots of oranges and greens and purples, whereas traditionally American comics are blues and reds and yellows. Mm. So that gave it a kind of a different European sensibility. Maybe it's like you were saying about Martha, it's two things that you wouldn't expect to see together overlaid. I don't know if you're going to come on to asking me stuff about the Watchmen movie, but one thing that I think is going to really help the movie look like the comic book is that they have kept to John's palette. So the sets are kind of saturated with oranges and purples and greens, and it really, as much as the kind of individual details, just the colour atmosphere of it makes it feel like the comic book. So, you know, John should get a huge credit for that.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say, because I can think of cityscapes in Watchmen where he's just given them this sort of purple wash, and I've seen photos of the set of Watchmen, and it seems so detailed. Are they going to kind of push the colours in the way that, say, something like 300 has that sort of almost painterly look?
I really don't know about that. Okay. I mean, I know that the it's very textural. I mean, the props, the costumes, the sets and everything are very textural, very detailed. And as I say, the colours, even as they exist, are striking. It's not Dick Tracy, you know, that used a really wild kind of palette. It kind of works, and it still looks like dingy New York, but just a slightly different New York. But I expect that they will treat the colour in some way. Not in, I think, in the way that they did with Sin City, 300, where they completely desaturated the colour.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that it will have a very interesting texture to it. But I'm as excited as you to see what that's going to be.
When it came to working with Alan, presumably your first collaborations was on Future Shocks for 2000 AD?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the work you'd done for DC Thompson, was that on sort of gag strips for like the Beano and stuff?
Oh, no, I did at a very early stage in my career do some kind of Bigfoot stuff, which was actually working for IPC Fleetway. They used to have a readers page where the readers would send in jokes on postcards,
okay.
And they'd give me half a dozen postcards and say, draw this up into a layout. So, you know, quite often they should have just gone with the kids' drawings, you know. So I did do that humorous stuff, but the stuff that I did for DC Thompson was actually kind of science fiction stuff.
Oh, okay.
It was a thing called The Wriggling Wrecker, which was about this kind of fungal tentacle thing that ate concrete and was demolishing buildings all over the place. And then I did another thing called The Shark Men, The Year of the Shark Men, about this there's this subaquatic race that kind of was a menace to mankind. Pretty, and actually a lot of those stories were adapted from earlier text-only stories that had run in the DC Thompson. So they weren't, frankly, great science fiction, but it was that kind of area, adventure science fiction.
Because I was going to say, I mean, the Future Shocks, in a way, they're like a combination of hard sci-fi, but with like a punchline almost.
Yeah.
Because you have to tell the complete story in 8 pages, and it has to be memorable, you know, and end in a gag. And when it came to your drawing, I suppose it's a different comparison because there's the Green Lantern Corps backup strips, but in a way it was a similar idea. You'd have a set up a story and then there'd be like to use a filming term, the camera would pull back and it would show that the Green Lantern is a planet or something,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So when it came to adapting those, did you think in terms of camera angles and stuff that we're going to start off small and then, you know, pull back?
I don't know that I ever particularly did that, but I mean, those were a lot of fun to do, those Future Shocks. I mean, that was at the very beginning of Alan's career, and of course, that's the way that they would start new writers off, was with a little story, because it's not a great risk to the magazine. It gives them a chance to show what they can do. And obviously, it was apparent very, very quickly that Alan, you know, was capable of doing much more than three-page twist-ending stories. And he was, I mean, it used to remind me of the kind of things they'd have in a comic book called Amazing Adult Fantasy, which was Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, where, you know, you'd realise this whole planet was just in a drop of water or something like that. And I did a few of those with Alan, and it was good because we got to work together and we became friends and sort of understood the way the other one thought. So, but there was one particular story I remember called Chronocos.
Okay.
And that was a really complex thing that Alan came up with, where it was a spoof of Dragnet, the old TV series. And I kind of drew it as a homage to the mad parody of Dragnet.
Okay.
And, you know, kind of swiped a couple of the characters out of there. But it was a homage, as I say. It wasn't really a swipe. But it was a very complex thing where they're in three places at once, and they're in the lobby of the Chronocops building, and there's a bit of foreground action, and they're also hiding behind a potted plant, and they're also walking across in the background. And that was very complex, and I think we both there got a real taste for complexity. And I think, as Alan said somewhere in an interview, he realised that I could draw anything he asked for, no matter how outlandish. So, yeah, I mean, that was a real, a little kind of a catalyst or whatever for working together on Watchmen, I think.
And when it came to doing that sort of thing, do you find yourself making models in a way so that you could see the scene from different angles before drawing it?
I would sometimes, if it was a complex setup, maybe just draw a plan of it. I was trained as a building surveyor, so I can think in terms of... but quite often, if you do that, the interesting thing is if you draw out a plan or draw a sketch kind of layout of it, that just internalises it in your head anyway. You never have to look at that. I remember for another thing that Alan and I did, a Superman annual story called For the Man Who Has Everything. It features a character, Mongol, who's a kind of a big, bulky, alien bad guy. And he's got this kind of jutting brow, and like a lot of comic book characters, the way he's drawn from the side doesn't actually fit with the way he's drawn from the front. And in comic book kind of iconography, you can accept it, but I thought, no, I'm going to really have to work out what this character looks like. So in plasticine, I made a Mongol. But actually, because I then understood so completely the three-dimensional form, I didn't have to look at it. So I don't often make models. If you've got to draw a specific thing, particularly a gun or a car, it's really handy to have a model, more valuable than having a photo, because you can visualise it. But strange enough, earlier on today, somebody said to me, when you draw a picture, do you see it in your head in 3D, or does the picture appear 3D to you? And it actually does. I realise that that's actually one of the unspoken things about drawing, that you're using two dimensions to express the three dimensions you see in your head. And when you get really involved with the drawing, you feel like you're moving in and out of it. You've stepped over the edge of the picture and you're aware of the three-dimensional space. And that's what building models and things does. Okay. It just reinforces it, a sense of three-dimensionality. So yeah, it's an interesting area.
So actually then, your collaboration with Alan on the Superman annual was the first work with him that you've done that's seen adaptation to another medium, because they did it as an episode of the Justice League cartoon.
That's true. Yeah, I was very thrilled to see that. And again, I mean, the guys who work on that Justice League cartoon, which is Bruce Timm and lots of other really excellent artists, they were really keen that they do it right. You know, and of course, I had to compress it tremendously and miss stuff out. But it was a real kick to actually hear lines of mine, Alan's dialogue, just as he wrote them, and to see picture setups exactly as I visualise them, but actually moving. And we got sent some money for it as well, so that was very good.
So they had actually used your original drawings as almost storyboards for doing the cartoon?
Yeah, I think they had. Yeah, I mean, there were some compositions, Wonder Woman firing this big, you know, sub-ionic blaster or whatever it was, where it was exactly the shot, you know, or the way Mongol squatted down, and it was very well animated. And as I say, they've really done their best to, within what they had to do, adapt the feeling of the story and the sensibilities of it. Yeah.
I mean, you've visited the Watchmen set, and you're now writing this book on sort of behind the scenes of it.
Yeah.
How does it feel seeing it being adapted, you know, to another medium, one that's actually completely 3D? It's almost going in the opposite direction of what you were talking about, visualising in your head first.
Well, that's interesting. What I'll just make clear, first of all, is that the book that I'm doing, which is going to be called Watching the Watchmen, is actually about the creation of the graphic novel.
Okay.
Because I'm quite a collector, and quite a hoarder, and I've actually kept everything from when we were doing Watchmen.
Okay.
All the notes, even the little doodles or lists that I'd write when I was speaking to Alan on the phone, press cuttings, when we went on signing tour of Britain, all the posters, and there's loads of photographs. And I suggested to DC that this might make an interesting book. And they agreed, and I think, speaking as a fan, but my fan had
it's just the
kind of book I'd love if I wasn't involved in it. And so I've really found some stuff that even I forgot about. And I'm really pleased that it is being done, because it does re-establish where all this came from. And where it came from, the original spark, it was from Alan Moore's imagination. So it's really nice to in that area to re-establish that. And I think a lot of people who see the movie will be interested in exactly where it came from. But as for visiting the set and seeing it all become real, I mean, that was the strangest, weirdest, most you know, surreal experience that I've ever had, to see things that, again, as I say, the idea for Watchmen took root in Alan's head, but all the visualisation is what I saw in my head. And to see it in three dimensions, and actually, in the case of the owl ship, to stand inside it.
As like I had, inside your own head.
Yes, and as I imagined it, you know, what it would feel like. And everything has been so faithfully taken from the graphic novel. I mean, everywhere you looked on the set, everywhere in the production office, were images from the graphic novel, maybe blown up 6 foot high, but obviously everything is based on that. They've changed some of the costumes, which I would expect. But the attention to detail is, it's a bit uncanny. In some ways, it's like having a dream, because no matter where you went on the set, it all kind of made its own kind of Watchmen world sense. They had the comedian, his costume looks exactly like it does in the comic book, and the guy who plays him, sort of just the right persona. And I went and shook him by the hand and he slapped me on the back, you know, just like the comedian would. And I said, oh, I like the guns, because he's got like these chrome-plated Colt 45s. So he said, oh, sure, have a look at one. And I looked at it, and on the butt of the gun, it's got a little plaque, and it says something like, presented to Edward Blake with grateful thanks, Richard M. Nixon.
Wow.
And this is kind of, you're probably not going to be able to ever see this on the screen, but it's there, and the actor knows it's there, and it has been put there. Things in the display cases have got little plaques, all of which make sense. Framed newspapers on the wall, not only the headlines make sense, but the stories aren't just grouped in text. They're the actual story of Night Owl falling in the background.
I suppose if you'd known 20 years ago that they'd been making a movie, you'd have been absolutely terrified, thinking every single coffee pot that I'm drawing in the background is going to end up on screen. Maybe I should.
Well, that's true. I mean, we obviously had no idea then that it would be made into a movie. And I think what's interesting is that, both the way Alan writes and the way that I draw, I like to think everything in Watchmen is internally consistent. So when you make a movie of it and you build a set, it kind of works, because we didn't do things like, you know, you see in some comics where people are together in a room and then somebody has to come in through the window and you think, I should have drawn a window, I'll just draw a window now, you know. Everything was planned from the ground up. So I think they had a good solid foundation to work on. But yeah, I mean, it would have been a very intimidating thing to do, to think, oh, I'm actually doing the blueprint for a $100 million movie, you know.
When it came to drawing the original comic, though, did you have any idea while you were making it of the cultural resonance that it would have in the years to come, that it would be, you know, what many people consider the definitive superhero story?
No, I mean, I don't think when you do any creative thing, you're having thoughts like that. I mean, to me and Alan, it was just, you know, we were having the chance to do the sort of comic book that we would really like to read. So we pulled all our love of superheroes and, you know, a lot of the phone conversations we have, you know, the story, the names of the characters were there from the beginning with Alan, but a lot of the phone conversations we had, we'd go on for hours, and we'd be talking about the feeling we used to get from an old Kirby comic, or a particular scene in an issue of Jimmy Olsen, or something like that. You know, that deep, because we're a kind of a similar age, I'm a little older than Alan, a similar age, and our cultural references were pretty much the same. So it was an encapsulation of everything we loved about comics. The storytelling techniques that we loved that Harvey Kurtzman used to do, for instance, you know, fixed viewpoint or moving viewpoint, things that Will Eisner would do. You know, it was really our tribute to comics. And although a lot of people characterise it as being a dark and grim and, you know, a deconstruction and a funeral for the superhero, really didn't feel like that to us. And for every, you know, bleak Rorschach episode, you've got Night Owl in his kind of fanboy basement with all these wonderful gadgets, you know. And certainly the issue where he and Laurie finally get it on is almost like a fanboy fantasy of get to shag a superhero, you know. So it's about that. So that's what we were thinking of then. Obviously, after we'd done a few issues, people from DC were giving us feedback. By the time we'd done about maybe five issues, it was in print and we were getting feedback from that. But even then, I don't think we would have thought that, oh, in 25 years' time, there's going to be a movie or there's going to be a brand new collection of it. Mm. That's, you know, right place, right time. I think the way the market was at that time, I think how we were at the time, we were at the age where we had the experience and the ability to pull it off, but we had the enthusiasm to want to do it in that way. And I think also the fact that it is a self-contained piece has given it longevity, because, you know, people go into comic shops and they go, where do I start? So the guy in the comic shop says, read Watchmen, you can pick that up. A lot of feedback that I had on it, you can cut this if I'm rambling too long, but when I finished drawing the comic book and they finally collected it in a trade paperback, a guy was painting the outside of my house and was looking through the window and he said, oh, what do you do, you know, comics? I said, yeah. He said, I used to love comics when I was a kid. Yes, it's Superman, Batman, and the Flash. I said, oh, well, actually, this thing I've just done, and it's all being collected together into a big fat book, so, you know, would you like it? He said, oh, yeah, okay, fine, thanks. So he took it away, and the next morning he was late. He used to come out at 8 o'clock in the morning, didn't get it till about 10 o'clock. He said, oh, I'm sorry I'm late, Dave. I said, oh, okay. So he said, but it's your fault, you bastard. Why did you give me that book? I said, what do you mean? He said, I went home, and when I went to bed, I thought I'd just have a little look at it. I had to read the whole thing. I kept my wife awake, didn't go to sleep till 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, oh, it's great, is there any more? So I said, well, no, that's kind of it. And also, just as an anecdote, I moved house, which is why I was having the new house painted. And when the first copies of the individual comic books came through, the guy phoned me and said, oh, there's a box here for you, you know, if you want to come and collect, it's been delivered. I picked it up, I said, oh, it's the first issue of Watchmen, this thing I've been working on. And I said, you know, would you like a copy? And he said, oh, no, that's all right, Dave, I don't read comics. So I said, okay, fine, but just have one anyway. And a month later, he phoned me, oh, Dave, there's another box here for you. And I went back round and said, okay, thanks for the box. Oh, it's issue two. And he said, Dave, could I have one? So, you know, it's connected with people like that. And that's something that I'm particularly proud about, that it has got a resonance with people other than comics readers, you know, that it's spread beyond that. But there was a lot of luck, there was a lot of coincidence, a lot of fortunate timing. But now I can't say that at any time we felt, you know, this is the book that will live forever, you know.
You've mentioned in passing some of the comic book artists that you're fans of, and that you've thought about with compositions like Will Eisner, Harvey Kurtzman. I've read interviews with you before, you talk about Frank Bellamy.
Yeah.
When it came to drawing Watchmen, there's obviously kind of like the main art style. There's the style you use when drawing the pirate comics. Yeah. There's style for like maybe the photos in the magazines and that. Did you self-consciously kind of vary it and actually bring in your influences when it came to curating this?
Yeah, I mean, the Black Freighter stuff has got a kind of an EC Comics sensibility to it. Yeah. I mean, the drawing style isn't hugely different. I think the greatest difference is in the way that John Higgins coloured it, which was to make it much more lurid and use much kind of hotter and surprising colours in it. I mean, the stuff in the text features, again, maybe that does stem from the sort of thing they used to do in Mad Magazine, where they do spoofs of books and things, and artists would kind of vary their style a bit too. And I've always liked, although, as I mentioned earlier, colour has always been a little bit of a mystery to me, I've always liked halftone, you know, grey ink wash and things. So I used to really enjoy doing that, to try and make something look a little bit like a photograph. And of course you've got to draw in a different format and a different scale. So if you're drawing it in ink wash, it inevitably ends up looking different, just a line drawing. There's a degree of adaptation. It's still recognisably me, it's still recognisably Watchmen. But it was quite refreshing to draw those kind of pirate scenes, particularly because a lot of them come in the middle of quite talky, static street corner scenes, and then you get, you know, the guy on the raft with a bunch of corpses underneath. It sort of keeps the visual interest up, you know.
Cool. I mean, you're saying that you enjoy using half tone and gray shading. One of your graphic novels where that's most apparent, but you seem to be having great fun using that, is the one that you wrote as well, the Originals.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the genesis of that project?
Well,
you big Quadrophenia fan.
No, well, I mean, it is a good movie. Yeah. I mean, it is a good movie. No, the thing was, you know, I'd been told by Karen Berger that, you know, it was about time I really wrote and drew something. So I'd done quite a lot of writing for other people, a hell of a lot of drawing of other people's scripts. And I thought, yeah, I should, but if I'm going to do something, it's got to be something I really care about. It's not, it's got to be just more science fiction, more superhero, more. And I thought, oh, no, you know, it's got to be something I really care about. Now, you know, I'm a middle-aged guy, kind of respectable. I like to think I have no prejudice against anybody because of, you know, race, colour, religion, sexuality. You know, really, I think I'm a very tolerant kind of guy. But I was driving in the car one day, and a guy went past me on a motorbike in black leather, and I had this urge to just swing the car, just knock him off the motorbike, which is a terrible thing. I mean, I'm not proud of that, but I felt it intensely. And when I see guys go by on motorbikes, the words that come to my head are, fucking Greece. Because when I was 16, 17, I was a mother. I had a scooter.
Okay.
I had a fantastic scooter. Mm. I liked the clothes, the music, and everything. And, you know, the Greeks were sworn enemies. They were everything that we would despise. And still as a middle-aged guy, I still had this thing. I thought, that's kind of interesting. Why do I feel this irrational prejudice? And this irrational prejudice I feel must be the kind of prejudice that other people feel for other identifiable groups. I thought, that could be interesting. And I got all excited about the idea of mods and everything. And I went on Amazon and got lots of books and panels. Yeah, I'm really excited by this. And I proposed it to Karen Berger, and she said, oh, that sounds really good, fit really well with the kind of Vertigo stuff. And I then started to write a story. Now, a lot of the incidents in the Originals actually happen, or they're dramatized versions of what happened. The very beginning of it, where our guys meet the scooter gang, is more or less exactly what happened to me.
Okay.
And just like they did at the beginning, these guys rolled up on scooters and said to me, where are the Greece hiding? And I had to know that these were the Boreham Wood scooter boys, and that the week before, the London Coney, the place I used to live, the Greece had pulled one of the Boreham Wood scooter boys off his scooter. And this was obviously the Boreham Wood scooter boys come for revenge. And I said, oh, the Greece, they're up the corner around there by the playing field. And they went, thanks, mate. And they went and beat the shit out of the Greece. Now, I feel very proud of that. And I shouldn't, but I do. Mm.
You've got blood in your hands.
Well, yeah. I mean, the only difference was that in the comic book, our heroes go with them, and that's how they're blooded, and they become members of the gang. And a lot of the names in the book are names of actual people. And they're not the people, but they're the names that I remember. And they're nice because they're names like Lel and Bok and everything like that. But I did have a science fiction element to it, because I found scooters to be, I clearly remember the first scooter I saw, and it was just like something from another planet. It was so beautiful and so sharp and stylish and so unlike anything, and the guy riding it was so well dressed and clean cut, but kind of dangerous looking, I wanted to give that same kind of sense of wonder to the comic book. So rather than have the scooters with wheels, they're kind of hover scooters, which just gave that little bit of a lift. And it's recognisably a kind of a post-war setting, although it's not quite clear which war and everything like that. So that just gives it an interesting little twist. But then I knew I wanted to make it look a cool book as well. It had to look really sharp and well designed, so I thought, yeah, I'm going to have a black grid, and I'm going to make it a little bit smaller than a comic book to make it feel more compact. So it felt like a really condensed, dense little thing, you know. So that was the kind of genesis of the Originals. It took me a long time to do it, and it was just working by myself without a collaborator, and I really missed it, having a collaborator. And it was quite a hard slog, and it was a lot of pages, and must have met a couple of times. I thought, oh, I'll keep on with this, but I'm really glad I did, and I'm also glad that I wasn't tempted to kind of sex it up, make it more kind of Kirby-ish. Yeah. With great respect to Jack Kirby, you know, not make it into a kind of a hyperactive, real way out of science fiction, but to actually ground it in my real experience.
Interesting thing was my eldest stepdaughter, who's 19, I gave her a copy of it, and she's very artistic, and she's got very strong opinions about things, and I actually thought she probably won't even read it. But we actually had one of the best conversations I've ever had with her, because she said, oh yeah, and she said, why don't you like these people in leather jackets? And I explained, and she could understand that, because they were kind of equivalent to the day, and she felt that it authentic. You know, so what's really terrible is middle-aged guys trying to write young people's comics and be hip. I hadn't done that at all. And she found it really authentic, and she really enjoyed it, which is unusual. So yeah, I'm quite happy with it. It hasn't been a huge seller, hasn't been another Watchmen. Doubt if they'll make a movie of it, because as you say, there's already been Quadrophenia. And of course, it's going over similar ground. I mean, I was actually there. I would have to say I think Quadrophenia is an excellent evocation. There are a few details in it which don't quite ring true, but that's the original.
Cool. Great, we've run out
of time. Oh no, just when I was getting going, just when my voice was coming back. Yeah,
cool.
Thanks very much. Enjoy that.
In the next episode of Panel Borders, I'm talking to David Lloyd, who illustrated Alan Moore's seminal anarchist fable V for Vendetta, as well as the strip and prose character Night Raven. I'm talking to Dave about those serials and about his graphic novel Kickback, which was originally published in French and then reprinted in English by Dark Horse Comics. In comics news, on the 19th of July, there's a one-day comics and zines event at The Plough in Museum Street in London, where various zine and small press creators will be sharing their work with each other and members of the general public. There's more info about that at www.comicsandzines.wordpress.com and on my blog at www.panelborders.com. Thanks for listening.